Blog Talk Radio.
I would like to welcome everyone to John Talk Radio tonight. This is our January the 28th, 2017 episode. My guests tonight are the Timmons Brothers. We're going to talk about Eric Clapton, a living embodiment of the history of rock and roll. Eric Clapton was the first three-time inductee into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame when he was honored as a member of the Yardbirds in 1992, then with Cream in 1993, and finally as a solo artist in the year 2000. As a young performer, he described himself as an English kid playing the blues, being just strong, and possibly explaining why it was not popular in some respects. But a few years later, he earned the nickname Slowhand and inspired the scrawling of Clapton is God graffiti around London. With inspirations ranging from reggae to country to rhythm and blues, his loyalty has not been to a single style, but the integrity of the music. Despite the bouts with drugs and alcohol addiction, Clapton is not only a survivor, but an artist who has maintained his stature as rock's preeminent guitarist. I'd like to welcome John and David to the show tonight.
How you doing, John?
I'm good.
John,
there you are.
Can you hear me now? Okay.
Yeah, well, I can hear you. It's coming in loud and clear now.
Okay, good, good. John, I'm looking forward to this show. The more I've read about Clapton, the more of a complex individual I have learned about him and his most unusual background and journey to become who he did.
Well, I just want to ask you guys, we started the show off with Sunshine of Your Love. Do you remember the first time you heard that, and what was your impression of that song?
To me, it was a changing of the guard in the sound of music. Cream to me opened up the doors for psychedelia. When you listen to that song, and when they were formed in July of 1966. That was a big change in the sound of music, because right then we either had garage rock or your basic Beach Boys sound or something. And I think I'd introduced a lot of different bands of what Cream was creating between Baker, Bruce, and Clapton. And I think it was when I heard that song, I said, man, if anything else, I said it was different.
How about you, John?
For me, John, it was kind of a paradox in terms. If I remember right, it came out, what, in 67? Does that sound right, for the Sunshine of Your Love? So it's a summer of love, and the song has love in the title, but it sure doesn't flow with just a loving feeling. It's kind of got a hard, dry melody to it, kind of a different sound that was so unusual for the time. And yet at the same time, the title, Sunshine of Your Love, you don't expect it to be the kind of melody and the lines of the song that it is.
You know what they would have told Dick Clark had been hard to dance to.
But yeah, that's true. I was thinking of that when it was playing. I was thinking of one. I'm a little older than you guys, and I was in high school during that time, and I remember this being the time of the hippies. There weren't hippies around earlier, and then all of a sudden people started talking about hippies, and they started, my sister went to Ohio State University, so I would go there and visit her, you know, with my parents, and we would see these kids, you know, with long hair and with beards and with the holes in their shoes and their pants, and it was this whole different thing, man. It was like, I remember kids were listening to Bob Dylan, and they were, you know, that music was revolutionary. And I remember going to the Ohio State Fair with my dad. My dad was a buyer, and he's actually a livestock judge for Producers Livestock. And he would go there and judge during the fair, and he would take me with him, and I could just, you know, run around at the fair. And I can remember, guys, going to see the hippies. And isn't that funny? It's like,
yeah.
We saw all these long-haired kids, and they all smelled like patchouli oil, and they were, you know, it was like, wow, what is that? And I can really remember listening to Sunshine of Your Love, and I think the thing that got me was Clapton's guitar, like that heavy fuzz sound, you know, and another thing that's going to be happening at John Talk Radio in 2017 is we're going to start a show called Gear Talk. I haven't come up with a name yet, but it's just going to be about the gear that's used in music, and we're going to like look at a production or a time in the studio and then break it down. I think this would be a great song to break down. That sound? Yeah. Was he playing a Les Paul, or had he gone to the Stratocaster at that time?
At that time, he was still playing the Les Paul. He would go to the Stratocaster early in 68.
Okay.
And like I said, I would love to have one of them models, but if you break down this song, if you see there's a big thing here, what I like about is the solos and how the bass comes in there at the right time. And if you think of anything else, you know that heavily influenced what Jimmy Page would later do down the road. It had that Zeppelin sound to it. And like I said, when Slohan decided to pick, but the funny thing about him, he didn't want fame at the time. And that was amazing to me.
I totally understand that. I think that, you know, we've talked about this on this show before. I've talked about this with other bands before, about how that a lot of musicians, a lot of artists are not comfortable. I think, John, we talked about this before. They're not comfortable in front of a lot of people. So in order for them, they get anxiety and they get stage fright and they get panic attacks and they get all these different things because they're not used to it and don't like it. And so a lot of times, like you were saying, David, they wouldn't want to be famous, or they just wanted to play their music, but their music or their art or their poetry or whatever it would be was so good that it propelled them into fame.
And
a lot of
why,
them did, yeah, they didn't know how to handle
it. That's why
it,
he left the yard. That's why he left the Yardbirds. When they made that song For Your Love, he did not want that recognition. And it was amazing to me. Later on he would, but John, I think it comes down to two different things. I think when you're a music artist, and I know you talk to different music people, yeah, we love to write songs and we like to make a little bit of money, but I think there's something when that fame hits you. I call it the Peter Frampton system. Can I keep doing that again? Remember, Frampton just disappeared basically after that. And I think that scares some artists. Can we stay at the top?
Well, I totally agree with you. Along with the thing we're going to do this year with the gear, which I'm really excited about, and I've got some people lined up to do some great shows already. We're going to talk about there's one guy that's going to do a show just on one particular guitar that was passed down through the years. That's going to be cool. And one other thing that we've talked about last year and that has come up in some of the meetings Mark and I've been going to about addiction, we've been trying to help people. Marcy lost her brother Bob to addiction two years ago, and we've been trying to help people with different programs and whatever we can do, and to see that how many. I think this is very interesting, and this ties in with Eric Clapton because he dealt with heroin. He was a heroin addict. He wasn't just like a pot smoking, you know, have a couple of drinks guy. He was a full blown heroin addict, and for him to get through that, what do you think, guys? I'm going to ask you this question. I think this is very, very interesting. If you're a young artist, a young guitar player, a young band in the 60s, and you look up to people like Eric Clapton and Keith Moon and Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin, and you look up to these people and you see what they're doing, do you think that happened a lot? Do you think not only did their music and their positive music, which is eternal and great, influence people, but also the dark side of rock and roll, the side of addiction, the side of you really can't play rock and roll music, guys, until you're stoned or you're drunk or you're something like that. To me, that's something that I think rock and roll has this black eye, this stigma of, you know, taking a lot of prisoners and a lot of dead bodies on the trail from that. What do you guys think of that subject? Not the happiest of subjects, but it does come up with Eric Clapton.
It certainly does. And, he abandoned basically music and rock and roll for almost, a year and a half at one point. And I think for Eric Clapton, in his case, we need to remember how he had a distrust of people in general. When I learned about his childhood, I think he was like 9 or 10 years old when he learned they had been living a lie with him. His grandparents, they were acting as his parents because his mother had him out of wedlock, and they told him she is your sister, and they told him that his uncle was his brother. And it wasn't until 10 years old that he was able to start putting things together. And
now, that,
I think
that wouldn't mess you up. What would?
Yeah, exactly.
You talk about
exactly.
Dysfunctional.
Talk about dysfunctional. And
oh,
I think
goodness.
So. I mean, the reason I'm going that far back, because I think it really led to him. And I think that's one of the reasons he bounced around playing with so many different artists and always looking for the perfection of the other side. And I think that the drugs was something that was reliable, it was consistent, it would be there for him. And not saying that's a good thing, but it was the thing that he knew that it wasn't going to talk back in voice, it was just going to freak him out. But I think that look at his situation, even when he got over the heroin and the other drugs, even by the 70s, when he was over that, he was starting to fall into an alcohol as far as his overall type of addiction. And they said in the 70s, most of those concerts, he was performing while he was intoxicated. And he said the thing about it, he could play just fine. You wouldn't even notice it, but it was obvious he was intoxicated.
Yeah, they call those functional alcoholics. You can see in some of the pictures, guys, that you look at him, he just looks terrible.
Joe Walsh went through that.
And that's another great story, David, of how Joe Walsh has come through that and playing better than ever. But I think, tell me what you think, David, about that, these bands come out and people think, I've got a party like that to be a rock and roller.
John, here's my opinion on this, and I've done a lot of rock history and a lot of stuff. It comes down to two things. Most of these young Englishmen, young Americans, were very young. Most of them become stars before they're 22, 23. The world's out there. They're not ready for what they're going to be facing. They don't realize, well, I'm famous now. People's wanting to see them now. The pressure's on them to produce. Yes, we make the first 45, it does big. The second 45 gets a little bit tougher. And I want to explain to younger people, 45s were records back in, but the time it gets to the third one, we're in the studio. What do I come up with? The first thing I do, too, I go to a couple of artists might go to a couple of joints. Makes my head clear a little bit. Does that help me? I get a 45. It's a hit single. Maybe I should use something stronger. And Dan, I think with the young people, they read about them. And you brought up Keith Moon, and you talk about a dysfunctional person. Keith Moon was his own worst enemy, but they influenced the younger artists, and I bet you talk to young artists now, and it's an artistic thing. I shouldn't say this, and I'm saying in a way a musical person say LSD, heroin was used more or less as a point of artistic value. That's the way they looked at it, and this goes back to artists and musicians. I know Van Gogh got high to do paintings, and I just think I just part of what they did of being an artist, and I know it's wrong. I know a lot of young people don't make them heroes, and I'm kind of glad now people speak out, the older artists, so the young people do not make that realize addiction is addiction. You can be addicted to anything, and it's an addiction. And with Eric Clapton, the first one that noticed Clapton was really struggling, and I might be getting ahead of myself, was the Rainbow Concert. And John brought up this. He was away for a year and a half. Well, it was Peter Townsend and Steve Winwood came up to him and said, you cannot fight this by yourself. And Clapton had – and it was hard – but to me, addiction is always going to be in the music world, not only in rock and roll. It's in country. It's in opera. Hank Williams is a good example. Died before he was 30. So it's always going to be there, and I just hope the young people realize it's not going to make you a major star, but I think with your artists, I think they needed that for the anxiety attacks. It just part of – and you brought up Janis Joplin – that lady fought anxiety all the time. So it's tragical, but it's part of the music scene too.
Yeah, I totally understand that. Just what gets me a little bit is like when I start looking into the, like I'm really into the 60s and 70s, get into that mid 70s somewhere in there. And then what happened was when you had the grunge in the 90s and you had a lot of heroin addiction and a lot of barbiturates and things like that. And the music kind of got really dark in with the grunge music and things
Kurt
like that.
Cobain.
Yeah, and bands like that, correct, David? And I just sometimes think that what can people do? Is there anything people can do? Ricky Bird was a lead guitar player for the Joan Jett and the Blackhearts, and he has been clean and sober for at 27 years or something, and he has his whole thing right now is to play music for people to get them, you know, for young addicts and people that are in music and that think that drugs and alcohol go hand in hand, and when you find out that, you know, it can be very detrimental to your health. He's doing a great job with that. But I was just thinking about it. I wonder what, and I've heard that Eric Clapton's place he has in, is it in the Caribbean or somewhere, he has a recovery center? Am
yes,
I right there? Yeah, that he goes there and talks to people. And I like when Marcy and I were in this one meeting with this one Dr. Pratt, he said that they get nothing but high grades from his recovery center, that he visits and works with people in a grassroots level. Like I think you were saying, John, I mean, he's the guy that would know exactly what somebody's going through. I mean, when you talked about his relationship with this family, I mean, it's kind of funny in a way that, like Star Wars, Darth Vader saying, "Luke, I am your father." If your sister walked up to you and said, "Hey, I'm your mother."
Yeah.
It's like, what? Just
I
think about
like
that.
Luke,
if my sister walked up to me and said, "Hi, John, I'm your mother." I tell you what, I don't know what drug I'd be on, but I'd be doing something.
And John, it got worse than ever because when he put two and two together and he realized this, he talks to her. She comes back to the home and thought he'd get this loving reception. She said, "Well, Grandma and Grandpa, being your mom and dad, have done a good job up to now. Let them just continue. I'm leaving again.
I'm out of here." Yeah.
Yeah.
Strike two.
So, yeah, I mean, it was certainly just when he thought maybe he would get a welcome reception, and because he figured this out, he said that this mistrust just continued. One time when I think he was like 13 or 14 years old, they sent him away to visit her, and she had married and had a second family. They were his half brothers and half sisters, and this might have been when he was 14 or 15. And one of them, his prize guitar he had bought at that time, or actually was given by what he thought was his parents, his grandparents. His half brother comes in excited to see him, jumps on the bed and breaks the guitar in two.
Whoa!
So Eric's going, "What? What did you just do?"
And it was typical Eric, though. He showed restraint. He said he didn't get mad. He just isolated himself more, and he didn't want to be there, yeah, and knew he didn't want to spend any more time with them.
Yeah, that's incredible.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know what is also interesting, guys, about Eric Clapton is that when we talk about him and we listen to his music and his legacy, and you know, to us he's like a hero. Where you said in the intro where people were saying Clapton is God, because he was doing things that, and when we look at this tonight, he did things that was no one ever did before. I mean, no musician did what he did,
definitely.
Went through what he did, and like we just barely talked about the Yardbirds, but that. Maybe one of I love the Yardbirds. I just they're incredible band. I've always thought they were so good, and he was he left them what most people would do anything to get in, you know. But to him it was like you said, David. He was not comfortable, and he wanted out. Didn't he go to the Blues Breakers after that?
Yeah, he joined John Mayall's band. And John Mayall wanted to keep him in that band. And the key thing there, Eric's own drug problems hurt him with John Mayall. He was getting well recognition. But when you listen to some of them blues numbers, they do an old Lead Belly song. I got it on a 45, John, and when you hear that, it is classical blues. B.B. King would have been proud of him. That's what I'd say. And but Eric fought his own demons, and I think that's what made him so good. I know George Harrison tried to get him to go to India with him and thought the transcendental meditation would help him, but he didn't want to go to India, and I remember that one. So it's amazing what all Eric could do and all the bands he was in, I think because of his problems, kept him in different bands.
Yeah. What were some of the things, John, thanks, David, for that. That was very good. What do you think that made him who he is today? Because you talk about the instability of his family. I mean, that's what most people have as their foundation. Right. And then the spiritual thing, what you were talking about, David, were then like George Harrison and some of these people went to a more spiritual. Well, he didn't want that either. So what was it that you think made him the person that he is today or that musician that he became?
I think that his early on, he considered himself a purist. He may not have labeled himself that, but he was really wanting to be so true to the blues sound that it was almost like he was running away from popularity, from fame, because he saw that as you must be selling out if you're selling a lot of records. And every now and then you get people like that. I know Peter Green with Fleetwood Mac was
awesome.
That way. Just when they were ready to make it big, Peter Green didn't want any more to do with it, you know. And
plus he was crazy, but outside of that, you know.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
That's probably not the right word to use. Yeah, he had some problems, but.
Yeah. But, you know, if I can just mention also, since we mentioned Peter Green, believe it or not, he was the one that filled in for a while for John Mayall and the Blues Breakers when Eric Clapton left the band and was calling John Mayall, say, I'll be gone for a week, I'll be gone for another day. And they're like, are you coming back? And at that time, he was trying to find himself, and he was playing with some other artists. And John, you know, and John Mayall had these gigs they had to fill. And then when Clapton came back, it was a short time there. They filled back in, but shortly after that, he would leave on a permanent basis. But to your question, John, I think that it was always trying to find the what is the pure sound, trying to be true to it. And I don't think it was really until probably when he gained confidence and didn't feel he had to be that he was just a sideman until really maybe the mid to late 70s that it was okay to be popular. It was okay to be a lead singer. And if you do have a song that's a pop hit, there's nothing wrong with that. He was so resentful toward pop music for a while there. He said, yeah, I liked what they were doing. And he was talking about the Beatles. But he said that I just felt that they weren't doing enough that was pure music. Now, this is when he was like, we're talking 1964, when he was trying to find himself with the Yardbirds. And he said the Beatles were everything all of a sudden. They were skyrocketing late 63, early 64. And he really had trouble dealing with popularity and have huge record sales.
So maybe what I'm getting from this, John, is his continuous searching was his strength.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was. And I think that's why he played with so many different artists along the way. You know, we know the bands, the Yardbirds and then with the John Mills and the Blues Breakers, and then he had the course of time with the supergroup Cream, and then it was the Bonnie and it was Delaney Bramlett and Friends, and then he formed the Derek and Dominoes out of members of it. It was like always searching, trying to find this ensemble that will be pure as much as I am, and doing it for the love of the music, not looking for record sales. And he just had trouble accepting there can be a compromise there.
I think it helped him too, John, when he played at the Rainbow Theater that night in 1973. he didn't have to be the main guy, and that's what Peter Townsend told him. He said Steve Wintwood would be there, Rick Rich, George Harrison. All you have to do is be there, and I think that helped him. And I think that's why George Harrison had him play at the Bangladesh concert, trying to help his confidence. And because I think what it was, your home life and everything, and I think that's what made him such a good guitar player. If I got to prove one thing, I'm going to prove to myself I can be the best. And I think in all these groups he was in, and I think he never really caused conflict in the groups. He would just walk away from them. And that was usually in a band, somebody raises all kinds of cane. You're not doing what I want or everything like that. But he just would walk away. And I know with Cream, I got to bring this up, when Jack Bruce, they had a reunion concert and he thought everything was settled between the two of them. And they get ready and they're rehearsing. And he told him, he said, you guys got to at least speak to each other on stage because we'll never get through this. And I think Clapton got tired of being a referee with Cream. And when Bruce and could get into it with Baker, it just never bland. And I got an old live 8-track tape. It finally broke from one of their live concerts. And if you listen very closely, it's Jack Bruce telling Ginger Baker to go you know where. And I thought myself, right in the middle of the concert. That sounds more like the Kinks.
Yeah, that's what, like John was saying earlier, maybe Eric's just trying to make peace and stability out of another bad relationship where, you know, he came out of a family, which you can't get any more dysfunctional than that. That's the poster board for dysfunctionality of a family. I mean, of course, you maybe build on that, but I don't think you could get any worse than that, knowing that your sister's your mother. So building on that alone would freak anyone out. And then getting in bands where people don't get along. And then he has to be that. And like you said, David, instead of being the patchwork guy, he's just saying, hey, you guys want to fight? Fight. I'm going on. I'm moving on. Like you said, John, I'm searching. I'm going to keep moving. I'm going to keep on this path. I'm going to keep looking. I'm not going to just settle in and collect all my money and go sign autographs, which on that note, I have heard that he's very, whenever anybody approaches him, he's very polite. And people have said, you know, they've seen him in the Central Ohio area, that he's approachable and that, you know, people have walked up to him and he signed things.
I have to tell this Eric Clapton story. This was told by a friend of mine that got the meeting. It was in Upper Arlington, and they were at a McDonald's. And they was wondering why this young girl said, why is all them people going up to this old man wanting his autograph? And finally, my friend had to tell his daughter, he said, that's Eric Clapton. And she said, who is he? You know, I thought to myself, there's the generation gap.
There it is. Yeah, that's incredible. Well, my first Stump the Timmons Brothers is going to be probably the easiest layup you've ever had. It's really easy. But I think when we integrate this in, you know, if we do have people that are listening in that want to know more about this, this will just help that. This will be like a building block or a stepping stone of Eric Clapton's career. The question, the first Stump the Timmons Brothers, his first big band he was in was the Yardbirds. Name the first, second, third, and fourth lead guitar player for the Yardbirds in chronological order. The first lead guitar player, the second, the third, and the fourth. I don't care who wants to go first.
I thought there were three, so I'm in trouble.
I know definitely Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, I want to say, I know Jimmy Page comes in there, but I think there's another guitar player involved in this. And I know them three for sure. Boy, but I'm trying to think who would be the fourth.
So it was Clapton, it was Beck, and then on to Jimmy Page, right?
Are you asking me if that's the correct order?
Yeah. Is that the correct order?
No.
because there was somebody probably before Eric Clapton.
You want me to give you hints, guys?
But I just don't know who. I mean, I'm guessing because I didn't know there was anybody. I didn't know there was anybody after after Beck and Page. So.
Me either.
Well, there's been a lot of them, but they're in the in
well,
the.
It, hey, John,
of
is
the
it one of the newer? It's
no,
when they read.
No, it's not that. Okay. We're cutting off four.
I don't have a fourth person.
Me either.
In
mind. You got me on the fourth one. I have no idea.
Well, actually,
John.
The fourth one is the first one.
Okay.
Okay.
So Jimmy Page is the fourth one.
So this is a trick question, basically.
So what I said then, there was a lead guitarist before Eric Clapton became a member of the Yardbirds.
All I'm telling you is there were four, and the last one that you guys got was Page was the number four.
Yeah.
Okay.
I know he was number four, but I'm trying to place who the other one. I think
well, if you
got
go
me,
back,
John.
you've named them all but the first one.
Yeah, the first one. Would he be known for something else if we
in another band later on?
He was a producer, and he still plays. He still tours, and he has played with a new version of the Yardbirds in the last 5 years or so.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I got somebody in my head, but I'm not for sure. And I think you got me because I'm trying to place who this other one would be.
I could give you
I have a feeling I've never heard of him, so
neither.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll give you one last hint. He's not at the bottom of the list. He's at the
top of the list. I guess is his name Top?
Okay. His name is Top.
It really
Top.
Is. Okay, I had no idea. I had no
Top
idea.
Topham? You guys have ever heard of Top Topham?
Yes, he was a big producer at Atco Records, too.
Now, he was the very first Yardbirds guitar player.
Yes.
Okay.
The lead guitar player.
Well you got me that time, fair and square.
Please, now, I've interviewed the newer guys, two of the newer guys in the Yardbirds, John Iden, who is the lead guitar player.
That's who I was going to get. Now,
yeah,
John,
he
I
plays,
know you had him on your
yeah.
show, and I talked to him once, and that's who I was going to say. And
there's been a bunch of them since Page, but I was just going for the first because Top didn't get the credit that nobody talks about that Top except, you know, they always talk about Eric and Jimmy and Jeff, which are the three best amazing guitar players.
Yes.
Topham can play the guitar, people. He's good. He's blues. And he, if you ever get a chance, now I don't know if he's touring. He's not in the current tour with them, but he was the Topham band was playing, and they were playing around. So wouldn't that be cool to see? That would
be
it.
Now, John, did he leave the band then basically because he didn't want to stay when Keith Rock decided let's get some top 45 hits, man?
I think he went to college. I think he left to go to college.
I was wondering why he left, Dan. I'm just curious, you know.
Yeah, I think a lot of those guys were young and their parents. I'm not completely sure on that, but I believe it had to do with his career and going on, moving on.
That's a good question, though. Good question.
Yeah.
I liked it.
Well, that's
it threw a wrench into us.
I think. I've got one more, too, so we'll do this one later on, unless you want to do that one now, but let's wait a little bit. Why don't we play another Eric Clapton song? John, you gave me some great songs. I mean, wow. Let's play Crossroads. What do you guys want to talk about that a little bit? That's another Cream song.
Oh, it's one of my favorite ones. When you hear Crossroads, you get that good, what I call the Clapton sound. And if you're a fan of Sci-Fi 3000, which I like to watch on the TV, the puppet the other day, I enjoyed it, Johnny. This criminal said, "Let's hear Crossroads," and the puppet says, "That's a good Clapton song."
Yeah, those guys are funny.
Yeah.
Mystery Science 3000. Is that?
Yeah, I love that show.
Yeah, that's good. Well, let's play it. This is Crossroads. My guest tonight, John and David Timmons. We're talking about Eric Clapton, and we're talking about this guy who is an incredible artist. He's a humanitarian. He helps a lot of people these days. He works with people that are in addiction, and he's still kicking. He's, 73, 74, you think, guys?
74,
like
just turned 74.
Yeah. And he's quite a guy, and he also has a house in Central Ohio. So if you're listening to the show off in, you know, other countries, you know that that can be kind of exciting because there's not a lot of excitement here. So people have seen him walking around, and it's kind of cool. So let's play Crossroads, and we'll be right back with John and David.
Jackson, please, on vocals.
Big finish on that song, Eric Clapton. He's at the crossroads. I think he was at the crossroads a couple of times. For real.
Oh, definitely. but you know, there's a place in London. It's a place they played was called Crossroads. It was a small club, and it was near Mushwell, England. And so I think sometimes, I don't know if he's for anybody's career, that little club that called the Crossroads in London. It makes you wonder at times. I know that was a place where a lot of the English bands played.
Isn't that where Robert Johnson, man, he wrote that, right? He was at the Crossroads.
Yeah.
And
that's where people
say sold his soul to the devil and all that.
Right.
That's what they say, man. I don't know. Yeah. The whole thing with, you know, he became famous and popular and all that. But let's go down the road with Eric Clapton a little bit, guys. So he starts off in this band that the Yardbirds and gets popular and people start thinking, wow, this guy's pretty incredible. And then Cream comes along and blows everybody's mind. And then, like guys were saying, it wasn't quite, you know, enough for him. He just kept looking and searching for that, you know, that sound and where he wanted to be in that place inside of himself, I think. That comfort place that he was looking for that he wasn't finding. And he was looking for it, I believe, in music. And you also said, David, something that makes sense with his anxiety and the uncertainty that he was trying to find peace through, you know, intoxication and sedation and all of that. And he finally found out that you could possibly get there if your body would ever hold up. But that's the thing that happens, man. People are trying to find this Zen place, this place of peace in their mind through drugs, but their bodies can't hang on for it. You know, their livers give out. It's just a terrible thing. So where does he go from there? He's in Cream. What happens next?
I have a story that while he was in the process of wanting to leave Cream, so I think it would fit in here, he was really admiring the band and their music, because he felt they were purists. They got it. They combined a little gospel, a little southern music, some rock and roll, some blues. And he went out of his way. He went up to Woodstock. This is pre-Woodstock concert, and this is where they were. And his intention was, when he was going to search for them and how much he had heard their album. Now, would that have been the Big Pink, probably about that time?
Oh, yeah. I'm a big band fan.
Just so enthralled with that album, he just had to go and meet them. And his intention when he went there was actually he was wanting to become a member of them. And when he walked in at the time, he was so impressed with Jimi Hendrix's hairstyle. He got his own hairstyle like a fro. He was wearing that Afghan type of real bright colored outfit like you associate with a hippie. And he thought, when I saw them, they were so, like, down-to-earth, wearing flannel and blue jeans. And it was like, you know, I met them all. I just couldn't get myself to say, you know, I'd like to just be a part of your guys' band. But they had a really nice interaction. And Robert Stigwood was the, their manager for Cream, who would later become huge with the Bee Gees and in terms of the disco and the RSO label. And he would be calling Robert from the USA, you've got to get me out of this band, the sooner the better, there's other things. And he wasn't telling that to the other two Cream band members, Ginger Baker and Jack Bruce. Here they were touring, and he's on the phone off to the side like, I got to explore other things, you know, get me out of this. So that was kind of a disappointment for him, because he thought he had found his niche with the band. But even though they were receptive to him and talked to him, he just couldn't see himself becoming a member. So that was kind of a missed moment. But fast forward, and we'll come back to it, but years later, he would actually end up doing an album with those members, one of the solo albums from the 70s. So it might have happened some years later, but eventually the band and Eric Clapton would work together. So that's my story about what's going on with him while he's in the process of thinking about leaving Cream.
And I got another story while he's getting ready to leave Cream. He meets the members. He's out in L.A. and meets the members of the Buffalo Springfields while Cream's on tour. Well, Stephen Stills invites him to the house with all the Springfield. Lo and behold, they have all kinds of drugs there, and the house gets raided. Stephen Stills, the only one that gets away, he jumps out of his own window when the rest of them get caught. So,
oh, wow.
He basically, when he was touring with Cream, and I like what John told about, he was calling Stingwood all the time, get me out of this band. And he really, that last tour, he did not want to be with them. And he sat in on some sessions with some other artists. And that's where I think he ran into Delaney and Bonnie, too, while he was out there in L.A. The same time George Harrison was out in L.A., and George Harrison had his wife with him, which Eric Clapton was always stalking her all the time. It was just part of it. And so you had this situation. I want out of this band. And that's where he runs into, lo and behold, Steve Winwood had just left the Spencer Davis group. And so we get talking to Steve Winwood. So we get ready to basically form Blind Faith. Now, at the time, we don't know this, but he thinks Winwood's a great artist, and so this is what we get this go-between in between the bands. So it's some interesting stories.
What do you guys think of Blind Faith? I mean, they didn't last long, I don't think.
One album.
Yeah.
But I think with Blind Faith, you had Steve Winwood and Eric Clapton had the same personalities. I think that's why the Clash didn't last more than one album. But if you ever listen to this album, it had a lot of potential to it, but it ended up in the cutouts a lot quicker than people thought because they each one of them wanted their own. I think he had two pre-Madonnas at the time. I think that always causes problems. And I think Winwood wanted total control, and he wasn't that old yet at that time because when he was with Spencer Davis Group, John, am I right on this? He was only 16 then, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was very young. And the one thing about that, Clapton saw Steve Winwood, said his voice was in a teenage body. He said, this guy sounded like an old blues-type singer, and he just was impressed with Winwood. And if he couldn't be a member of the band, he kind of warmed up to it was Winwood. Because he saw that same kind of potential, they could really be purists and they could do the music for the music. But here again, Robert Stigwood gets involved and he hears that Winwood and Clapton, two big names, are getting together. He's like, there's so much potential, like money here. He said, Ginger Baker's not doing anything. Why don't you guys include Ginger in your band? And Harry's thinking, oh my gosh, I just walked away from him with Cream. Now you're telling him I got to play with him again, you know? And so Ginger Baker, according to Eric, was kind of a guy that was really peaceful and gentle once you got to know him. But his first impressions, he was kind of antagonistic and just had kind of a mean skull on his look, on his face at times. And,
yeah, he did appear to look that way. Yeah, you're right there.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, that was not Eric's intention to have to be the kind of the referee again like he was with Jack Bruce and Ginger Baker with Cream, always being the one that just, you know, okay, guys, you can stop fighting now because we're going to play music, you know. So it was the group did perform live, and Eric, even though they drew a large audience, gosh, I want to say their first big concert was Hyde Park, now I believe.
Yes.
But it was like a huge reception, and Eric wasn't moved by it at all because he felt that they were just going through the motions, that they weren't really into the music as much as he wanted them to be.
Wow.
Well, even with John, even with Blind Faith would warm he liked the idea of the manager wanted to make them the main act. He said no. He said they were the warm-up act for Traffic, and that's what Clapton wanted. And Traffic wanted and the crowd was more acceptable to Blind Faith than they were Traffic. And I think Clapton says, my gosh, whatever band I get in now, we're going to be the major front runners. And most guys would have been happy with that. That made him unhappy. So it's really was unusual.
Yeah, that is unusual. That's interesting. I mean, I haven't read his whole. I started to read his book. you know, about his life, what you were talking about, John, the beginning of it. I didn't get through it, but I would imagine it would be fairly incredible to know exactly how he was dealing with all that stuff. And he was reaching plateaus that all these musicians would give anything to reach, but it didn't seem to be what he was looking for.
Yeah. And, you know, in the book, and that's what I've read here just recently. It's the autobiography. He made a comment that here they were playing in front of thousands of people in Hyde Park with Blind Faith. He said it was a beautiful sunny afternoon, and he pretty much, these are his words. I wasn't really there. I had zoned out. Maybe I was wrong, and that Ginger had not picked up, but I felt that whatever we had achieved up to that point in terms of bonding, rehearsing, and playing had been a complete waste of time.
Wow.
I remember thinking, if this is the first gig, I'm quoting, where the hell will we go from here? The audience may have loved it, and the atmosphere was great, but I really didn't want to be there. And that kind of sums it up right there.
Yeah.
Hey, John, here's a review from the Old Circus magazine I dug out of the archives. They review the last Cream album. Here's how it says, what in the hell has happened to Clapton and Bruce? They are in their own situation world now. This album gets two boots.
Wow.
And I think what it was, you remember, Circus was printed in England. And I think Eric Clapton probably called up Circus because it was a good album, but I think he wanted out that band so bad it didn't make no difference what he did.
Yeah, and so there he is going from you know, the Yardbirds to Cream to Blind Faith. Now what's he do? What happens next?
There's where I think his connections with the Beatles really starts helping him now. He's a good friend of George Harrison, even though the wife controversy. George Harrison has him come in. They're working on Big White. This is when we're working on My Guitar Gently Weeps. One of the few times that the Beatles bring in another artist, and on Big White they do. Well, Clapton sets in and plays leads on that, and also he's in the All You Need in Love sessions during Sgt. Pepper time. Paul McCartney and John Lennon persuade him to be there, and if you've got to look very closely to see him in the video, he's the one in the white jacket off to the far side, but he is there, and I think it's more George Harrison trying to help him to get going again, And if you listen to his guitar licks and My Guitar Gently Weeps, it's amazing, especially, and I like to bring this up, he was after George Harrison's wife like a bloodhound all the time. And George Harrison was very jealous of her. And you'd think that would have made them direct enemies, but the friendship always stayed there, and it's amazing. But I got to give the Beatles credit. John, you agree with that. They did help him, didn't they?
Yeah, I think we can just step backwards for a moment. It's how his relationship with the Beatles was rather interesting. As you heard me mention earlier, at first when he didn't know them, he was not really impressed with all their popularity. But nonetheless, they were the Beatles. But what Dave's talking about when they are working on a White Album, the interesting story here is he was so pleased that George asked him to come in. He was looking for a certain sound on While My Guitar Gently Weeps. But he said, once I got there, he said, I felt like I was playing the role that I did with Cream. I was being the referee because John and Paul were on their best behavior while I was there. I could tell. He said that they were like being all chummy buddies, you know, and to him. And he was like, I didn't come there to be the peacemaker. And so George brought him in to play guitar, but he felt he was there for another reason. But here's an interesting side note. He got one of the first, as far as the acetates of the White Album before his release, and he's taking it back to the West Coast because George said, here, take one. You're on, you know, one of the songs there, and we want you to have this. And so he's going to all these parties and playing it, and he gets a phone call from George that's hearing about this, and he gets a verbal tongue lashing over the phone that he should not have been playing it public. It was just meant for him. And he said, therefore, even though George and I would be friends, I learned never to not let my guard down around him because I saw a different side of George, and I thought I would just help him to make people aware of the album was going to be coming out.
Wow, that's
interesting. That was the number one issue, too, John. It's very valuable. That was the number one, the Big White.
Oh, my. Yeah, I can understand that. I can see that, too, because a lot of people that are I know that, you know, could be very passionate about that, and for him to just start playing it for people before it was released. Yeah, I could see that being a problem. That would make sense to me.
And then John Lennon took him, John under his wing in the Plastic Ono Band. And John,
yeah.
John, you tell J.D. the story about the flight to Toronto. This is classic.
Yeah, this is the following year, I think, maybe right after Blind Faith. It was late in 69, I'm pretty sure of that, and they're having this rock and roll revival concert with some of John Lennon's heroes performing live, everybody like Chuck Berry and Little Richard. And John calls Eric Clapton that morning, and, Eric, what are you doing? He goes, oh, I'm just sitting around here. And he goes, well, how would you like to go to play a concert? He goes, when? Tonight. And so he said, 3 hours later, I'm on a plane. I'm with the band. They call them Plastic Ono Band. It's Klaus Voormann, John Lennon, myself, and some other artists. And he said, there we were on a commercial flight rehearsing a song, and our only rehearsal was while we was going across the Atlantic Ocean. He said, when everybody seemed to enjoy it, they were getting a free concert. And he said, you know, we sounded pretty good. When you consider our only rehearsal was in the air flying from England to Toronto. And so he said, but that's John. He said Lennon just called him out of the blue. And he said that it was the strangest day. And he said, and the next day I'm back in England thinking, what in the real did I just do?
That's a good story.
But the Beatles really tried to help him, though. And that was the point of it. They seen potential in him. And in between these times, then, he meets Pete Townsend. I brought up about the Rainbow Theater concert. And Peter Townsend has to do a benefit. And so he said, would you be willing to play with Winwood again? And he said, I talked to George Harrison. He's going to be there. I believe Leon Russell was there, and he said, would you like to play in our band? I said, we're not going to ask you to do a lot. We just want you there. And so he was very skeptical, but once he got to the Rainbow Theater, I don't know if you have that album in your collection, John, but he does a version of Little Wing, and it's really terrific.
I haven't heard
and,
that yet.
And if you ever get a chance to hear that album, it's very rare. I had to find it in an import to get it. And once you hear that cut, but there again, the friends were always willing to help him. And the only mistake he made that night, Keith Moon was backstage, and Keith Moon wanted to know if anybody could out drink him. Well, Eric had to take the challenge. And who out drank Keith Moon?
Wow.
But that the Rainbow Theater, but he had a lot of loyal friends, and that's what I think the point of this, they all wanted to help him, and I think that was the key thing. But his relationship with the Beatles, then he runs into Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, and I believe at that time they was working on Sticky Fingers. There's two versions of John, help me on that song that was on Sticky Fingers, a single, John.
I'm trying to remember. Would it have been Brown Sugar, or was that rather later?
Brown Sugar. And there's two versions of that. Well, Clapton played on one of the versions on that. And if you get the second CD on that set, it's Eric Clapton playing. And like I said, his relationship with all the artists was good. But I think, again, like, and I think you guys both brought this up, he got tired of being the referee in all the feuds, though, in all the bands.
Yeah, that's kind of like one of those things where, you know, I'll never know what it's like to be rich and famous, and that's okay with me. I'm cool with that. But a lot of these guys that got there, you know, didn't seem to be all that happy when they got there. So, I mean, he was there. I read the other day where how rich he is now. It's incredible. But yeah, I mean, it's a lot of money. And I was just, you know, that's curious. That's a really good point to bring up about, you know, him personally in this journey that he's been on and he's still on. Why don't we take a music break, guys, and play a couple of songs. We have Cocaine, and let's play Cocaine and Promises. You want to say anything about those songs before we play them?
I guess the irony of the song Cocaine, by the time he was putting that down in 1977, for the most part, I would think cocaine was behind him, but I think it was a willingness to acknowledge it and that he didn't want it to control him. And I don't think he intended it to be a hit. I think it was meant to be a statement. It ended up being one of his biggest songs as a solo artist.
And Promises was heavily influenced by the Nashville sound, and he wanted to sound like he could go a little bit toward more of a country sound. Both of them was great singles, and if anybody's listening out there, if they got a favorite Eric Clapton song, I'd like to hear it too.
Yeah, well, let's play them. We'll be right back after these songs. You're listening to John Talk Radio. I'm your host, John Darlington. I have John and David Timmons with us tonight talking about Eric Clapton and a living embodiment of the history of rock and roll. So we'll be right back after this music break, and don't go anywhere.
Thank you. don't care if you never come home. I don't mind if you just keep on rowing away on a distant sea. 'Cause I don't love you when you don't love me. Cause a commotion when you come to town. Give them a smile and they melt. Having lovers and friends is all good and fine. But I don't like yours and you don't. Got a problem, can you relate? I got a woman, call it love, pain. We made a vow, we always be friends. How could we know the promise it won't end? Got a problem, can you relate? I got a woman calling love pain. We made a vow, we'd always be friends. How could we know that promise again?
And we're back on John Talk Radio. I promised the second Stump the Timmons Brothers, so we're going to do that. And this is also with the Yardbirds. And I have a quick question for you, John. When did you call in with two phone lines? Because I have a number up here, 803. Would that be one of yours?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did.
Okay.
Because I was having trouble there at the beginning. Yeah.
I just didn't know if that was you or if I needed to answer that. Okay. Here's Stump the Timmons Brothers, number two. Eric Clapton was in the Yardbirds, and the song For Your Love came out. And David, you talked about how that was their big hit song, and Eric wasn't really hip with that, didn't want that kind of pop stardom, and left the band soon after that. Who composed or wrote the song For Your Love, and what rock? He became pretty famous himself, the guy that wrote that song, and he was famous in a band that was popular in the 70s. All I really need to know is if you know who wrote For Your Love, and a bonus would be if you knew what band he became famous in.
Boy, this is interesting. In the 70s.
So the person that wrote For Your Love.
Yep.
Well,
that's who we need to know who that was. And he wrote some really great songs in the 60s.
I think it's a group, if I'm on the right track here, because I knew it wasn't one of the members of the Yardbirds because I just read the autobiography, and I think I remember reading this now. I want to say the guy at the time was writing songs, and he would become big in the 70s with 10cc. It might be Graham Gulman.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah, yay. Great band, 10cc. Rubber, load those rubber bullets.
What a great band. I absolutely love that band. I thought they were so good and so ahead of themselves and so creative.
Okay.
But Yeah,
Graham
Gouldman wrote some amazing songs.
You know, he wrote a lot of songs for the Hollies too.
Yeah, yeah, he wrote for a lot of people. He doesn't get as much publicity as a lot of folks, but good one, guys. Good one. Good one.
Well, the 10cc, the first album cover, is voted for one of the best album covers, with the rubber bullets where it's got the. And I remember when I bought that album, and John Kidney said, and I said, man, it's one of the best. My favorite song about it is the April Shower song, but I can't say the words on the air, but it's in it.
Yeah, I know the album very well. Played
album.
It a lot. Yeah, they were a little out there. Law Cream and was it Godley? Kevin Godley?
Yes.
Yeah. And
then they would spring off to form another band, if I remember right, and it didn't last as long, but I want to say, I can't think of the name of that band now, but they sprung off to another one.
That Godley and Cream worked as two artists together for a while, because they had a hit single called Cry, and it's listed in Guinness Book of World Records for one of the highest notes. The way they hit the word "cry" in it, yes, that's what I know them as far as the notoriety, you know.
Yeah, well, one of the guys in that band was Eric Stewart.
I think
he's an underrated songwriter and musician.
Yes. Oh, and you think of that band? I remember reading about them in Cream magazine when that album came out. They said it was the Beach Boys go Hollies go Grand Funk Railroad.
Go Beatles, because they had a lot of Beatles.
Yeah, they were so different on that album. Any song you played on that, and like I said, there's three songs on that, and I remember John got tired of me singing Load Up Those Rubber Bullets, because I wanted to do that with Razor's Edge so bad, and I remember the rest of them told me, you're not going to get to do it. I love that song.
Great bass in that one.
Yeah.
In that song. Yay. Yeah, so we got Mr. Clapton. What happens when he take us through? We got we have about 13 minutes left. What are some of the highlights and the things that happened between after when he started his solo career and where he is today? What are some of the things maybe that I haven't mentioned, John and David, that you guys would like to mention?
He went through a little bit of tragedies. I think the hardest thing for him to overcome, the loss of his son.
Yeah.
That was never easy for him when he made that one song, if you remember. If I don't bring a tear to your eye.
Tears in Heaven.
Tears in Heaven. And I've even sung that in church myself. And so it's one of them songs, and what he went through that emotionally, how he made his comeback. And one of my favorite Clapton songs after he was in all event was Tulsa Time, and he gave that song so much justice, how he would do that. And he like I said, he reinvented himself several times, and I think he's more or less relaxed with his life compared with everything in his older years. And I think he gets to play now with I know J.J. Cal, he made a Seed Life CD with him just recently. And I think he's more in a relaxed form, and that's my opinion now. And he knows where he's at now, and it took him 70 years to do this, but he does, and everything. I'll let John say his point of view.
Well, I think that he continued through the 70s to align himself with different artists and different bands, and I think we really need to mention the influence of Delaney, Bonnie, and Friends had on him, because their band would basically leave Delaney and Bonnie Bramlett to tour for a good number of years with Eric during his solo years, and they were the ones that really became Eric's backup band, if you will. Up until then, Eric might have sung lead, but they worked well together. I think they consider themselves the Tulsa Boys, and that's one of the reasons he did the song working on Tulsa Time. But he also aligned with all people. I don't know if you remember, the country performer used to wear a little like cowboy like small brim hat and a blue jean jacket named Don Williams. He had a real low voice.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And he met him, and he was just really so impressed with him, and liked this song Tulsa Time, and he enjoyed performing it, and became you know, something that he enjoyed doing live, because the band was all that he was touring with at that point were from there. And,
well, he came out on stage, John, with Don Williams in Nashville once, too.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so his alliances would continue, and I think that, you know, we mentioned the J.J. Cale songs. Of course, there we just played Cocaine, but After Midnight sure did well for him, too, was another J.J. Cale song. And then I think Clapton needs to be given credit for really bringing, as far as the reggae sound, more popularity. I think him doing I Shot the Sheriff brought more people to recognize reggae and reggae and be aware of it, that in turn it really did help the artists there, even though they had made it originally. He's the one that really made it more mainstream. And I got to think, by having someone like Clapton doing that, that would have a later influence. Maybe if you think of early Police, some of their songs were a little bit on kind of the reggae sound, you know.
Right, right, yeah.
And you would think, you know, being English, that not saying they wouldn't have heard of Bob Marley and the Wailers, but I think Clapton deserves some kind of an acknowledgement there for making that song, not just trying to duplicate what Bob Marley did. If you play him side by side, he definitely puts more of a Eric Clapton touch to it. It's you can tell it's reggae, but yet it's definitely got the Clapton sound.
Hey, John, then there's the album The Policeman Ball. Remember, I would buy this. I believe that was made in 1983. And lo and behold, the only time all three of them appeared on stage together, Page, Beck, and Clapton. They played their guitars, and each one traded guitar licks. And every time I played it, that album, then it's just amazing how all three of them, what I call the guitar kings, all three of them on stage, and I think that was probably one of his things there. And I believe, John, if I'm right at the Policeman Ball, I want to say George Harrison and Townsend were there too. So it was a big thing at that thing. And the album itself there did do that well. It's what's amazing about it, but it didn't get out too many places because I had to get a import version of it myself to get it. I don't know, if, JD, if you ever heard of it or not.
I've never heard it. Yeah, so that would be awesome to hear
it's
that.
It's a great album. You might go and check it out. It's a good album.
Now, he is having a very select tour this spring. I don't know if you guys have looked at it yet, but he's playing March the 19th and the 20th at Madison Square Garden. You can get tickets today and if you want to. And then he's going to play two dates in the Los Angeles Forum in March, the 25th and the 26th. Then he's jumping across the ocean to play at the Royal Albert Hall for three dates on May the 22nd, 24th, and 25th.
Will
so
there be any
art?
John, is there any other artist going to be with him on this tour, or as he said?
I don't see anything. I mean, it's not built that way. It's just built Eric Clapton. So it says Eric Clapton. It doesn't say, I'm reading here, David. It's about his celebrating his 50 years in the industry.
That is something.
But it doesn't say that he's got anybody with him.
I have a feeling. I feel like there's going to be some big cameos in that, probably.
You know,
people coming out.
Yeah, he picked three pretty good places, didn't he?
Oh, definitely. And I bet the tickets will be pricey.
Well, they say they start at $75, and I think what happens, a lot of people go out and buy all of them. Are they allowed to do that? And then, you know, then they sell them. I heard that corporations do that. You know, they go out.
Oh, they do. It goes on. And oh, man, that would be something to get to see him perform 50 years. It's amazing.
I think they're trying to create some kind of bill, though, that will limit people how many tickets that they can buy. I mean, I could swear that this was something about fair trade practices that it's that I'm pretty sure that it's actually going to Congress, because so many people have complained that they only have to buy off of like a third party market, because they can't buy directly because tickets are all sold out so quickly.
And then you have to pay $200 or $300 for a ticket.
Yeah.
Which is ridiculous.
Oh, it is.
I think. It's incredibly.
I got to tell this one Eric Clapton story, though. This was when, during the Bangladesh concert. Well, George Harrison calls up all the Beatles. Well, Eric Clapton is there. Well, John Lennon writes a letter to Paul McCartney. He said, Clapton's going to be there. He said, Paul, you could there and support the rest of them. Why? John said he couldn't show up. And I always thought to myself, that there was Clapton of Bangladesh, and that was one of the shows. And if there's a bonus disc you can get on CD where he does one of his, I wanted to believe he does After Midnight, and does an excellent job on it. It's about a 10-minute version of it, and it's one of my favorite songs from the whole Bangladesh concert. But I had to get that in because, well, if you want to hear him at his best, that is one of the best songs.
No doubt. What a great concert. Weren't there some of the members of Badfinger involved in that?
Oh, yes. They were probably the house band for the whole Bangladesh concert, I believe.
Wow.
They played about through the whole thing.
Okay, John, what do you got?
Only had a few days learning all the songs I heard. I was going to tell you, if Marcy's listening, I actually got a funny story that involves the Monkees, the Beatles, and Eric Clapton. It almost sounds like a joke, doesn't it? Okay, you know.
The Beatles, the Monkees, and Eric Clapton went into a bar.
Well, it was right before Sgt. Pepper's released in 67, and they had what they called a speakeasy, and it was in London, and they were at this place. It was like a bar late at night, and it was just select people there, and they are all there to, and then when the Beatles come in, they bring Sgt. Pepper. It just hadn't even been officially released yet, so they're getting to hear it, and Clapton writes they were doing drugs and LSD, and now he doesn't tell which monkey, but he said then the Monkees came in and they gave us this drug they called STP, I guess not to be confused with motor oil, but they said it was a super strong acid. And so they all tried it, and Eric said that he was so freaked out when he took it, he was scared because for 3 days he was high and he could not eat meat, because every time he saw it, he actually would see the animal as part of his hallucination.
Wow.
That's a strong drug.
Thank you to the Monkees. I don't know if it was Mike, Davey, or Mickey, or Peter that gave him that.
You know, it could have been a side effect from bananas, too, being the Monkees, you know.
Some crazy bananas there, David.
But I just had to share that story. I'm like, I can just picture this. And it got busted at 6 a.m. in the morning. And Eric said when they all went out on the streets, it was like there was this kind of the it was sort of a shield. All these police were there. But when John Lennon came out and he all gave him the victory sign, the peace sign, he said it was wild. He said the police just stood and stared, and we all drove off, and none of us got in trouble.
Hey John, I gotta be careful kidding Marcy about the Monkees anymore. I run into her at Sunoco too much anymore.
Oh yeah, she'll get you. That's sacred ground there, David.
It is.
Yeah, we're gonna go see Mickey Dolenz again. He's doing a solo thing at the Kent stage. It's gonna be a one man show where he's gonna go through his whole career, like with the Circus Boy and the whole thing. He's gonna do a whole thing.
Oh.
Yeah, so we got tickets to see that. But
very
guys,
good.
Thank you. I really appreciate you being on again. It's just my privilege and honor to have you guys on. Thank you.
Well, John, I always appreciate the opportunity to come on your show and explore a topic. What I like about your show, we get ample time to dive into stories. It's not like a 2 or 3 minute blurb, and that it's fun to kind of analyze and really appreciate someone like Eric Clapton and the kind of the career he's had and what he's given us in music.
Oh, and John, one thing I want to bring up on your Gear show one day, I would love to analyze the song All the Way from Memphis.
Okay. Well,
down the road.
We've got – Yeah, Tom Guerra, who's been on my show several times, he's a big. He writes for Guitar Magazine. He's a huge Mata Hoople fan, so we can get him on. And he's the guy that wants to break down this one Stratocaster that's been passed on through all these different blues guitar players. And so, yeah, we'll have fun doing that. I got to set that up. I'm really looking forward to that. Thanks so much, guys. Have a great evening. We'll have to do it again. We'll keep doing it.
And, John, if I can just say, people, they can find out more about Timmons Brothers at timmonsrock.com.
Yep, and all the stuff when you guys have a gig coming up. So thank you so much, guys. So have a great evening, everyone. Thank you for being a part of John Talk Radio, and we'll talk to everyone later.
After midnight, we're gonna let it all hang down. After midnight, we're gonna chug a lug and shout. We're gonna stimulate some action. We're gonna get some satisfaction. We're gonna find out what it is all about. We gon' give an exhibition. We gon' find out what it is all about.
What it all about? What it all about?
After midnight, we gon' let it all hang
down.
Midnight, we gon' let it all hang down. I swear it.